the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Monique Brinson Demery is my guest. Her book, Finding the Dragon Lady, The Mystery of Vietnam's Madame Nu, tells the story of the First Lady of Vietnam and also the author's own story of her bizarre contact with one of history's pivotal personalities. Monique Brinson Demery, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me on your show.
You know, last year when your book, Finding the Dragon Lady, The Mystery of Vietnam's Madame Nu, was published in hardcover, you made an appearance with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. That must have been fun.
That was a lot of fun, to put it mildly.
When you wrote this book, were you expecting that would happen?
Definitely not. I didn't want this book to be scholarly or for people that already had a great deal of knowledge about the Vietnam War or Vietnamese personalities. I was hoping to introduce it to sort of a wider audience, book clubs and all that stuff, but I'll say The Daily Show is beyond my expectations.
Jon Stewart did seem to be knowledgeable. I mean, it seemed like he'd read your book, or at least his staff had briefed him. I don't know. So tell us a little bit about the origin story of Madame Nu. How did she rise to power, so to speak?
That was one of the parts that was so fascinating to me. I mean, I thought, you know, what little girl sets out and says, I want to be a dragon lady when I grow up? So I think she was born in North Vietnam when it was still a French colony. So I think a lot of her sort of ambition and personality developed because she had this kind of, this desire to prove herself. I like to call it sort of a chip on her shoulder, right? She'd been told over and over by the French that she was kind of a second-class citizen, but her family was this very elite family. Her mom was related to the emperor, so she had this kind of, well, I'm not one of them either. You know, she was kind of caught between two worlds. And then there was the fact that she was born a girl, which was a really big deal. Her mother was a young woman when she had her. She was 14 years old, and she knew that she was going to have to keep having babies until she had a boy. So when Madame Nu was born, she really resented the fact that this was another girl. She was sort of trapped in it. Then what happened was her marriage was kind of her only way out of this family situation. And so she married a man named Nguyen Nu, and his family was prominent in colonial France because they had resisted the French, and they were Catholics, but they were not, you know, colonial puppets. So they had earned themselves some notoriety for that. And when Madame Nu married in, she converted to Catholicism. And shortly thereafter, her husband's brother became the premier and then president of South Vietnam. And since he was a bachelor, he needed sort of a diplomatic hostess, someone to greet international guests and do all the things that first ladies were supposed to do, right? Visit orphanages and judge flower shows, that kind of thing. And Madame Nu, it just opened the door to her. I think she finally was like, aha, I have the potential. I'm going to make the most of it.
So when Diem became the president of South Vietnam, it was a new country. Was he the first president of? I can't remember.
Yes. So just a quick bit of background is that the Vietnamese had been fighting against the French from about 1945. At the end of World War II until 1954, when they defeated the French. And it was the Viet Minh, the communist army, that actually defeated the French. But in the Paris peace agreements, they couldn't, or the Geneva Accords, they couldn't give the whole country to the communists because the United States wasn't going to stand for that. This is sort of the height of the Red Scare. And so the country is split down the middle, and the North goes to the communists, led by Ho Chi Minh, and the South is supposed to become something new. And it was given kind of nominally to the Emperor Bao Dai, but he had been so discredited by this point that it was quickly kind of turned over, and Diem ousted him from power and became the first president.
And it was only going to, if I remember correctly, it was only supposed to be for 2 years, and then they were going to have a vote, whether
Correct.
Or not, right, to unify the country.
Correct. There were going to be elections, and the problem was that on both sides, they claimed that it wasn't that the other side had cheated, and so then it wasn't time for elections. And then when any election tried to be held, Madame Nu's husband, he made sure that the ballot boxes were all stuffed the right way.
So they did eventually have the vote, but or not?
No, they never had the vote that they were supposed to have as mandated by the peace accords.
Yeah. Now, so Madam New, and she had more than she didn't just judge flower contests. She had power, right? She kind of created her own power.
That's right. So she noticed, one of the first things she noticed was that her husband and his brother, the president, were effectively ignoring 50% of the population. They, women in South Vietnam, they didn't have the right to own property. They didn't have the right to have their own bank account. So she thought, well, this is really a great chance. And the communists were doing a great job of recruiting women to their side. So Madam New thought, you know, the least we can do is kind of, you know, talk about women and children and see if we can appeal to them. And so that was kind of her job, because when she presented it to the men, they were like, oh, yeah, sure, go for it, wondering kind of what effect she could possibly have. But she pushed through these family laws that were very important in that they gave women rights and agency that they'd never have. But they also, she took things a little farther, and the family code and this morality law, it outlawed dancing, it outlawed gambling and prostitution, it also outlawed divorce and push-up bras. I mean, so it was sort of a far-reaching encroachment into the private life of people.
And these were her ideas to put these in? Because she was wearing a push-up bra, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, she sure was. Her point was, and it is a good point, I think, that bears mentioning, is that the communists, again, were behaving like they were at war, and they were doing a great job of, you know, keeping the momentum going. And Madam New felt that Saigon might look like they were having a party and enjoying all this American money coming in and having these American advisors. And she wanted to make sure that the tone was serious, right? That this is a war and this is what we're fighting for. So I think that was kind of her point, but it was lost amid this kind of no dancing. How can you possibly outlaw dancing?
Yeah. Yeah. And now, when you say that she pushed these laws through, I mean, did she actually have any, you know, congressional, judicial, whatever power, or how did she make laws happen?
Well, she had a seat on the National Assembly. Those ballot boxes that her husband was stuffing, she won like 95% of the vote in her district or something, you know. And no one would dare run against her, and people were very careful to tell her the things that she wanted to hear. There's a great quote that she wrote down in her diary, and she writes, you know, it's so hard to be brilliant when you're surrounded by idiots. Even though people were sort of telling her what she wanted to hear, she was still incredibly frustrated that not all of her great ideas got pushed through.
We're talking with Monique Brinson-Demery, and her book is called Finding the Dragon Lady, The Mystery of Vietnam's Madam New. And she was really quite a character, and she's not a very nice person, was she?
Well, you know, there's two ways to look at it. Mm-hmm. I think history has shown her to be not a nice person, and they painted this really terrible portrait, sort of one-sided portrait of her. But she was older when I got to know her and spoke to her on the phone, and she couldn't have been anything but sweet to me, and she was... she showed me this sort of softer side to her. She was a mother of four children. She really did care very much about her country, and she wasn't trying to be a terrible person, but often just the way she came off and the way that the press portrayed her was as this dragon lady. So I think the thing she was most famous for was when the Buddhist monks, they were protesting her family's regime and talking about religious repression, and they were committing suicide by lighting themselves on fire in the street. And Madam New said, oh, clap our hands and have a barbecue, or, you know, something terrible, yeah. Something like she would provide the gasoline for the next one. So these horrible things, and the kind of thing that just went around the world, and in a moment wondering, how could the Americans possibly be supporting this regime if this woman is the face of the regime?
Well, that was, you know, I mean, a pretty awful thing to say. It's hard to... You know, I mean, there's no two ways of looking at that particular comment of...
I absolutely agree. There's no apology to be made for that kind of statement. And she was very polarizing and had all of these different complicated sides to her. On the one hand, she was doing these great things for women, on the other hand, she's outlawing birth control and divorce. So, you know, kind of this two-sided, and she was the kind of woman where things were either black or white. There was no gray, and yet I consistently found myself pulled by her in all these different directions.
Well, yes, because, well, probably because you had personal contact with her, and so you wanted to find things favorable about her. I mean, and in your book you say that she outlawed birth control not for reasons of her being a Catholic, but because she thought that South Vietnam didn't have enough people in it.
Correct. And outlawing divorce, that was rumored to be because her sister. So this, some of this is sort of scuttlebutt that, you know, they got some traction in, and there's probably some truth here.
Yeah.
Madam Nu's older sister was married with someone in the administration in her brother's regime, and she was going to leave him and marry a Frenchman and run away with a Frenchman. And to Madame Nu, that was just awful. The French were, that was what we were moving away from. Let's modernize and stay away from the French. And so she outlawed divorce because it was just going to be too much scandal on the family. So things like that.
Well, no, she was, you know, seemingly a very intelligent person. She spoke very well. She spoke several languages, right?
Correct.
And she also became kind of an international figure. There's a marvelous picture of her in your book, and you tell the story of Lady Bird Johnson coming to see her, and she showed her all of her tiger skins.
Yes. So one of the things that Madame Nu was most, one of the things that she recalled most fondly in her older age was this visit of Vice President Lyndon Johnson and his wife, Lady Bird Johnson, and they came over on this vice presidential delegation checking out what's really happening in South Vietnam. And publicly, Johnson said, you know, Diem, the president, he's the Winston Churchill of Asia. And then a reporter sort of pulled him aside and said, do you really feel that way? He said, hell no, but he's the only guy we got. You know, it was sort of like the best of a bad situation. But Madame Nu wanted to impress these American women and show them that she could be a little bit shocking, that she wasn't sort of the stereotypical Asian woman. She wasn't submissive, and she wasn't going to, you know, pour tea for anyone. So she took them up to her bedroom, and on the floor are these overlapping tiger skins. And every time her husband went hunting, he would bring home a tiger skin for her, and she would leave the head on, the teeth and everything, and I try to imagine her, you know, picking her way across those in the middle of the night.
Yeah, and you don't want to stub your toe on a tiger's mouth and rip your foot open.
Exactly. And the picture of President Kennedy's sister was with them on this trip, and she just looked horrified at the image.
It's great. It's really great. And but you know, it's interesting. You know, history. You know, in retrospect, I mean, the American involvement in Vietnam, you know, goes back to the Truman administration, as you were saying, but our real war in Vietnam begins right at the moment of Madame Nu and the coup that occurred in 1963 that led to the death of her husband and her brother-in-law. She was in Los Angeles at that moment. And, you know, it's been implied, and I don't know if it's proven, but that America was behind the coup. And then, you know, there was never really a South Vietnamese government that lasted longer than a few months after that, right?
Right, in the short term. So in August, President Kennedy did send a cable agreeing that it was time for a regime change. And I don't believe that he meant, you know, murder them and get them out of there. But I'm not, it's also hard to imagine what he thought was going to happen. Coups are not often peaceful, especially, you know, with a family that's been in power for 9 years, and they weren't going anywhere quietly. So it's reported that he felt terrible about the murder, you know, that it was just shocking to him, and he had to kind of excuse himself from the room when it was told that the men had been murdered. But it kind of also...
There was a woman in the other room. He excused himself because there was some lady waiting for him in the other room.
Yeah, maybe. That's very possible. You're quite right about that. But on that note, Jackie did say, you know, Madame New was everything Jack found unattractive, and it was because she was ambitious and longed for power and all that stuff. So I find that funny that the one woman who, you know, was unattractive to him was Madame New. And in fact, Jackie went so far as to sort of try to insult her and call her a lesbian, because anybody, you know, anybody who acted like that just had to be, you know, had to be a lesbian, which I... in her day, it was sort of a shocking thing to say about someone. and so the coup kind of, people say that Kennedy was really going to get us out of Vietnam, that he didn't care about the next election. He was going to start winding us down. And people have found papers to prove that point. But ironically, one of his last acts is, you know, approving this coup that did murder these two men. And that prolonged and complicated the American involvement in South Vietnam. Who knows what would have happened if they hadn't been killed, right? This regime was not a democratic regime. They weren't the good guys by any means, but
they were holding things together in a way that no subsequent regime was ever able to do.
Yeah, I think you said that really well.
We're talking with Monique Brinson-Demery. Her book is Finding the Dragon Lady: The Mystery of Vietnam's Madame New. And I guess that's really the starting point for you in this story, was you wanted to find the Dragon Lady.
Correct. When I started looking for her, I really was looking for, gosh, anything, even like a historical fiction novel or something. So I was looking her up on the internet, and one of the first things I found was a reference to an obituary. Not hers, but her parents. And in 1986, her parents had been living in Georgetown, outside of Washington, D.C., and they were killed by her brother. And I thought, what kind of complicated family story is this?
Yeah,
and why, I couldn't believe no one had told the story. So I started looking for her, and it was believed that she was in Rome at the time. But I found some documents that led me to think that she might actually be in Paris. So I started looking, and the search actually became like a sort of a physical search. I ended up walking around Paris looking for these apartment buildings that were over 12 stories high, and there aren't very many of them in this section of Paris. So I did find her, which was fun.
But you didn't actually see her face to face.
That's correct. So we played this kind of cat and mouse game where she would say, you know, so half of my family lives in France, and so I would go to France once a year, and she would say, okay, you know, the next time you're here, we're going to meet, and she would come up with these really elaborate schemes to meet. So it was going to be at a church near her apartment next to the statue of St. Joseph, or in this park by the third bench, and all of these kind of schemes. And at the last minute, every time, she would say, you know, oh, I'm not feeling well, it's a sign, I've got to stay home. But the interesting thing about this is that every time, so much of our conversations were about family. And I, at the time, I just had my son, Tommy, and she wanted to tell me all about, you know, breastfeeding, how important it was to breastfeed for at least 6 months. So, you know, here's the Dragon Lady giving me advice on, you know, nap schedules and all these things. And so she wanted me to bring the kids. I agreed. I thought, you know, what can she possibly do to hurt them? And I think she thought it would make her feel a bit safer if they came along. But so the baby and I would be walking up and down, pacing the aisles of this Catholic church, waiting for this woman to show up. And so unfortunately she never did. And when she passed away, I cried, because I was sort of sorry that this strange relationship was coming to an end. But also I was so upset that I was never going to be able to meet her in person.
It's pretty fascinating, and you know, did you ever suspect that, and did you feel that she was leading you on? Did you think, oh, I'm never going to meet her, she's just full of it?
Well, yes. I mean, probably the year before she died, I think it was, I had sort of thrown in the towel, and I started talking back to her in a way. You know, she had very mystical ideas about religion, and when she would go off on these kind of tangents, I would kind of try to bring her back, and finally I was like, we just want to hear about your story, we don't care about your, you know, vision of the universe or the world. And that was very offensive to her. So, you know, she would hang up on me or not call me for months, and I thought, this is it, I'm never going to get anywhere. But she must have known that she was getting sick, and she knew that this was going to be kind of her last chance So before she died, about 9 months before she died, she got back in touch, and she finally sent me her memoirs. And she'd been dangling these in front of me like a carrot for years, you know, saying, when you're ready, when you prove to me X, Y, and Z, then I'll send you my memoirs. So finally she sent the memoirs, and they were three volumes of 400 pages of why she was the greatest thing that had ever happened to the earth. So it was incredibly disappointing that she wasn't more self-aware by that point to be able to have a frank conversation about, you know, what it was like to be a first-hand witness to all these historical events.
Yeah.
But then there were some real gems in there too, some personal elements about her as, again, a mother, a wife, and what it was like to live in a palace when the rest of the country was so, so poor and at war.
She does appear in the television series Vietnam: A Television History. And you can I don't remember when that was made, but you can. She's sitting there and talking. She doesn't look very old there.
Yes, that was in the early 80s. I think that's 1982, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. She's wearing this bright red lipstick and this red dress. She looks pretty terrific.
Yeah, she's got these really high cheekbones. It looked like maybe she'd had cheek work done. I don't know if there is such a thing, but if there is, she possibly had it. But you talk in the book about her having some amount of plastic surgery or something when she was in Los Angeles at the time of the
coup. And it was not plastic surgery in the way that we think of it. It, you know, it wasn't Botox or anything like that. She had a sty, and so she was going to have it removed.
That's what they're just telling you. They're just saying that. Really, she had a facelift.
Oh, this is the code of Hollywood. I need to learn, right?
It's a sty. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Well, it is pretty amazing. So, it resulted in this book. How much of this book, Finding the Dragon Lady, The Mystery of Vietnam's Madam Nu, is from those 1,200 pages of memoir?
Not very much of it, unfortunately. So a lot of the things that we talked about on the phone, she referenced again in the memoirs. So that was nice. I had this sort of double, you know, the story that she told me over the phone, and then I would... And then I saw it in print. For example, I'm thinking of the story where there was a firefight, and she'd been captured by the communists. So this is during the war between the French and the Viet Minh, and Madame Nu and her infant daughter are captured by the communists, and she's being forced to march across this bridge. And in her memory, you know, she walks across, and there's gunfire, but the guns kind of go silent when she crosses the bridge. So it's that mystical sort of turning point in her life. And it was the same in the memoir as she told me over the phone. But some things, you know, I tried to cross-check as much as I could between what I would find in the archives and her stories that she would tell me. But things like that moment on the bridge,
yeah,
are impossible to, you know, check anywhere else. And I think that's why I told the book the way I did. I put myself in the story as sort of a first person because she's such an unreliable narrator that I wanted to give you, the reader,
a slightly more reliable narrator.
Or a tour guide, maybe.
Yeah. Wow. And you're continuing to be interested and involved in the history of Vietnam, because now you're working on another book that you're co-writing.
That's right. We've just finished. It should be out in time for the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. And it's a great story. John Reardon, he lives in Wisconsin, but in 1975 he worked for Citibank in Saigon. And he, when he was evacuated, he was like, well, what about the people that are working for me? So he flew back into Saigon as everyone else was leaving, and he personally adopts his employees and their families. So that becomes 106 people that he then gets out of the country on these evacuation planes, and they get resettled in the United States. And it's really just sort of this happy, uplifting, heroic story, which is definitely a different thing than the last book.
Yeah. Now, in the book, you talk about your own father. Your father was in Vietnam, or tried to stay out of Vietnam.
That's right. So he was, his draft number came up, and it was, you know, he was sure he was going in, so he said he walked down to his local recruiting office and signed up because the odds of that were better than being drafted their survival rates or something. And he was sitting there watching TV one night when the president came on and said, you know, anyone who's been accepted to graduate school can now defer. So he got out of it, but his friend, who was also in the same situation, could have deferred and gone to graduate school. He said, you know, come on, Gary, let's go get this over with. You know, we're going to have to go anyways. And this poor guy went to Vietnam and wasn't there 2 weeks before his plane was shot down. So growing up, that was always kind of talked about by my dad, sort of, wow, you know, the path not taken, would I still be here if I had gone to Vietnam?
And he said to you, you're so crazy to go to Vietnam, I was doing my best to stay out of there.
That's right. I went there as a student to study abroad, and my dad was like, I can't believe you would choose to go, you would sign up for this. But of course, it's a very different place now, and it's a wonderful place. I mean, the culture goes back so much farther. You know, we think of, in America, we think of Vietnam and we think of the war, but there's thousands of years of history there that are just beautiful and fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to go sometime. If it weren't so far, and there weren't so many bugs, and it wasn't so hot. Those are my rules. Those are my rules of travel. The book is called Finding the Dragon Lady, and let me say the whole thing. Finding the Dragon Lady, The Mystery of Vietnam's Madame Nu, and the author, my guest, Monique Brinson Demery. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. I hope you come back again.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for all your great questions.
Well, that's all the time we have for From the Bookshelf this week. I hope you had a good time, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Monique Brinson Demery. Her book, Finding the Dragon Lady, The Mystery of Vietnam's Madame Nu. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.